Well, welcome to this conversation with a man who's broadcast on just about every platform available within UK radio. Here's our very own Renaissance man, Paul Gambaccini. Paul, I don't think everyone will be aware that although they know that you were born an American, you have now also embraced a British identity. Tell us about your thinking there.
Well, I've looked at life from both sides now. That's all I can say. What happened was that as the new millennium came, and I thought, you know, I actually have been here a while now, and I should take British citizenship. And so I did. For some reason, I didn't have to take the quiz. But I did go to a ceremony, which was in Lambeth Town Hall. And it was, and I'm going to use an adjective, which might result in a letter to the editor of the Daily Telegraph, charming. I say that it might result in a letter to the editor of the Daily Telegraph because when I was interviewed about it once, I said it was cute. And that resulted in a letter to the editor of the Daily Telegraph who said, how dare you call British citizenship cute? Well, it was charming because there were people from all over the world, some of whom clearly, desperately wanted to be citizens, some of whom just thought it was a matter of convenience. But the whole thing was so full of good, natural feeling. It was just a room full of, yes, to use an old expression, good vibrations.
But you've kept your Americanism.
Oh, yes, yes. These days, believe me, you have to keep your options open.
Well, you and I have worked together on loads of different projects across more years than I really care to think about. But in a sense, that's how I always think of you, as somebody whose knowledge and whose skill set are unusually broad, which leads me to wonder, is there any type of music that leaves you cold?
Yes, and unfortunately, the number of types of music that leave me cold are growing. It used to just be thrash metal and its relations. And I still find that rough. But I've been terribly discouraged by the downward trend of hip-hop, of which I was once proud. Now, people may think, how can he be proud of hip-hop? He has nothing to do with it. But it was invented on my street in the Bronx, Sedgwick Avenue, by DJ Kool Herc in 1973. And this is actually true. He used to host parties in the recreation room of this apartment block. And he invented the use of multiple turntables, employing the same record at different points to lengthen the breaks over which people would do an Americanized version of the Jamaican toasting. And the expression hip-hop came from one of these toasters was discussing a man who just joined the military. Hip-hop, hip-hop. And that's where we got the expression hip-hop. And hip-hop at the beginning was a marvelous form of protest music and music that did reflect the streets. Think of songs like The Message, White Lines, and then the catastrophe of California taking over with gangster rap. And I have been presenting the American hits, as you know, for about 35 of my 40 years on radio in this country, and prior to that in college radio for 4 years. I've heard every hit. So I've heard every use of bad language by a major artist there has ever been. And I have found the descent of rap to be the most discouraging part of my musical life.
So do you think this is giving an editorial challenge to stations that are targeting a young audience?
Of course.
Let's move back directly to radio. I've seen you conduct numerous interviews and never seen a sight of a written note or an electronic prompter in sight. It appears almost as if you have an encyclopedic knowledge of all music trapped inside your head. Is there a technique in play here that maybe you could share with us?
When I was doing movie reviews on breakfast television, and we would cut to the clip, the other guests sitting on the sofa would look for the auto cue, and they'd be craning their necks all over the studio. And they couldn't find one, because there wasn't one. And Jesse Jackson said, "How do you do this?" And I thought, well, doesn't that take all? The great orator, Jesse Jackson, can't ad-lib to save his life. He memorizes all his speeches. But I suppose, in terms of television, the reason I started not using autocue was because I would have to put my glasses on for a faraway vision. And I didn't want to have to take my glasses on and off. That would look very awkward. But also, there was a mechanical imperative, which is that the wind-up sign would often come before you'd reach the conclusion of the script that was buried in the autocue. So in other words, you had to be mentally nimble.
So how do you develop that mental nimbility?
There is a state that I go into, that's all I can put it as, in which the subject matter at hand is the only thing that exists. I'm not thinking about my next meal. I'm not thinking about who I'm going to see when I leave the studio. I'm just there doing it with either the interview guest or, if I'm talking about a subject, the subject itself, living within that moment with that person and trying to respond to what has just been said. In other words, I don't go in with a clipboard. You're quite right. It drives me nuts to see people with notes who will go on to their next question regardless of what the interviewee has just said. The interviewee has perhaps just admitted to being an axe murderer, and the next question will be, "What's your favorite sport?" It drives me nuts.
So have you spent a lot of time before you go into this state of actually pulling in information specific to the moment that's coming up?
Well, what I do is I go into any interview knowing in my mind the subjects that over the course of the interview I will want to bring up. But it doesn't mean they have to be brought up in a particular order. It doesn't mean they have to follow at any specific interval. I will listen to what the person says. If there's an opportunity to transition into one of those subjects, I will. But I will respond to what the person says so that it sounds like a seamless interview. It seems to me that this is what people would want to do, to actually have a conversation with Barbara Streisand rather than just have her sitting there while you recite 10 questions. And I've had a couple of interviews with Barbara Streisand that were true conversations. And I've always thought, you get more fascinating material out of somebody if they're volunteering it, if they want to mention it, and also if they feel you're on their side. Now, you don't have to be on the literal side of the person you're interviewing, but if you are interviewing them from their perspective, put yourself, for example, into the framework of someone in a Brooklyn high school when Barbara Streisand was a teenager. And you can ask her questions about that. And she'll talk about being a teenager in a Brooklyn high school. And you'll get far more interesting things out of her than just subjecting her to a pre-planned inquisition.
Well, let me try another route to get more interesting things out of you. Your current output spans Lord knows what. I mean, there's Counterpoint Quiz on Radio 4, as well as series there such as For One Night Only, which I love. You do documentaries for Radio 2 alongside your regularly Saturday show. You've broadcast for Classic FM, for Jazz FM, and hosted network series across dozens of commercial local stations. But within it all, there's a constantly recurring format that has cropped up, and that's been your presentation of chart shows for all sorts of music. Now, I know, having worked with you, that you make a big point of always wanting to pick your own editorial content, the tracks you're going to play. So how does that square with your obvious, you know, enjoyment of chart shows, where by definition the music has been chosen by others?
I loved chart shows because I heard some of the very first ones in the late 50s. To this day, I can think of having my Monday evening dinner in my room, on my desk, listening to Peter Tripp on WMGM New York, doing the New York Top 40. And there have been many other examples of chart shows that I loved. Of course, the foremost being Alan Freeman's presentation of Pick of the Pops. He was the king. We all see that now. We all know that now. And I also, however, loved the widest possible range of music, even if it didn't include thrash metal and gangster rap. There have almost always been, within the chart shows I've done, an opportunity to champion new music and selected oldies. For example, when I was doing the American Hits on Radio 1, sure, I'd do the top 30. But also, I had this pick of, I had a half hour to pick selections that were going from 30 to 100, that were on the way up. And, of course, I enjoyed playing the genre number ones, the country number one, the rhythm and blues number one, and something from the number one album. So you have elements of choice, even if you don't think you would. And in Classic FM, where I had the great honor of presenting the most popular show they've ever had, the Classic Countdown, and as I say that, I tip my hat to Nick Bailey because we used to go back and forth with his Sunday show, Classic Romance, for the most popular show on the network. Of course, when you have a classical CD, you can choose the selections. So my deep love of music could be accommodated even in a chart show.
Okay, well, moving slightly tangentially, I can't help but observe that you have been and probably still are a man who's often in the vanguard when asked to comment on current news stories. I'm thinking of, say, the Russell Brand or Savile stories. But have you ever come to regret entering the fray in such circumstances?
First of all, it should be clear that I never initiate such reportage. I get asked.
But one of the problems in responding quickly is that you are sometimes tempted to talk about something before you know the extent of the debate of the story that's going on. That's what's behind my question, which makes me wonder whether you ever thought, oh, my God, I wish I hadn't done that then.
You have recognized the number of times that I do speak out. Imagine the number of times I don't. The number of times I get asked to comment on something that I consider is outside of my area, or, as you have cited, I don't have full knowledge. I won't comment unless I feel I have full knowledge of what it is that I'm talking about. Russell Brand I could talk about because he was on After Me, Radio 2. And of course, anything that happened on Radio 2, all the other presenters know about it because the engineers tell them. Savile, all I had to talk about the time that I did was my historical experience of just having been there. I mean, it was just coincidence that for 8 years, the office of his producer was next to the office of my producer. So I haven't sought out to make trouble, but of course, almost anything you say, you have to realize, will be repackaged, sliced, and sometimes served up in a way that you don't recognize. I once got an email from Jonathan Ross saying something to the effect of, it's nice to have friends. And I thought, uh-oh, what's this about? And I actually had to Google to see what was in the paper today about Jonathan Ross that I had said. And the Daily Telegraph had a huge story that day. Gambaccini calls Jonathan Ross an icon of greed. And I actually had, but in an interview with another newspaper, in context, deep within the interview, I was trying to make a serious analysis of that matter. And of course, when you try to make serious analyses of these subjects, when the tabloid stories are almost always going to be short, you're asking for trouble, but you want to go on the record with a serious study. And this, I suppose, comes from my being a history major at Dartmouth in the United States. And I pointed out that Fred Goodwin, Fred the Shred, had been the national target of opprobrium for his huge checks while he was running his bank into the ground. And then it was the misfortune of Jonathan, right at the time of the economic collapse, to have the contents of his contract with the BBC revealed while people were suddenly feeling more precarious about their own economic situations than they had in generations. Along comes this. This man is receiving $6 million a year from the BBC. And of course, people don't understand production companies and that some of the money goes to the program makers and so
forth. Okay, well, look.
But nonetheless, yeah. But I did say, so I said, so Jonathan became an icon of greed. which he did.
Well, you've been critical, as you've indicated, of some of your colleagues, but you've also been fulsome in your praise for others. I recall that John Peel, David Jensen, Alan Freeman always seem to be in your top 10. So tell us, what are the qualities that you admire in broadcasters that cause you to praise them?
Commitment is the first. Commitment to the art. Is this person really a broadcaster? No. You may think, what is he talking about? I've lived long enough, of course, to see changes of all sorts. And some of them are for the better and some of them are for the worst. And one of the ones that is for the worst to me is the decision by John Burt to introduce what he called bimediality in the 1990s, which was that if a subject was covered on both radio and television, the television person should do that both on television and on radio. This immediately impacted on Radio 4, but then had a spillover to Radios 2 and 1, and then to the commercial sector, where a television celebrity would be helicoptered in to do a radio show, even if they'd never done radio, even if they'd never worked their way up. This was deeply insulting to us because it stated, in effect, that radio broadcasters do not have a separate skill set. If you've had 10 to 20 years of building up a technique, it counts for nothing because we've got a TV star who will come in and sit in front of the mic. Someone will engineer the program for him or her, and we're only interested in their star quality. So if you are as good as, and I will just mention someone who has suffered because of this, Richard Allinson, then you won't be on as much as you might have expected to be in your mid and later career because we've got a TV star. And I have, of course, honed ears. I hear what the general listener doesn't. I can just tell if a person is a television person on radio, almost without exception. There are a couple of exceptions. Dermot O'Leary has managed to make the transition with dignity. But that's because he's been willing to acknowledge that he has had to put himself in the hands of persons who know radio. And that is ego sublimation for Dermot O'Leary, because he is Mr. Saturday Night on television.
Do you think vocal quality has anything to do with it anymore?
I don't think that the great voice is a factor, which breaks my heart. I tune in to some of the new hires, and I can't believe how inappropriate they are for radio. Of course, the first great example of this was my friend, and hence I can mention her name, Janet Street Porter, who you may remember started doing a breakfast radio show with Tommy Vance. And no one had thought that if you can't see Janet, the mere sound of her is curious. Where is this coming from? This has gone on through time. You may remember Philip Schofield had a shot on Radio 1, which Doreen Davies, who was executive producer then, thought didn't work. Now, Philip clearly is one of the great stars of broadcasting. But there are some people where if you can't see them, their voice alone is not enough to carry the day because they don't compensate with timing or wit. And as a result, there's nothing special about them on radio. It's fascinating.
I'm interested you say that because the great heroes that you identify from your early days were part of that culture where it seemed to me that you had to have a certain vocal quality to get a job as a jock on American radio.
Well, I think immediately of my all-time DJ number one, who was Dan Ingram on WABC, who not only had a great low voice, but he had the best timing of all time. He could talk up a record right to the entrance of the vocal, which used to be considered a great and desirable skill. Strangely enough, there were three of us who could do it on British radio. Myself, Tony Blackburn, and Pat Sharp. Pat was great at it, but nobody thought about it or noticed because it was in the context of the station sound. But nowadays, people don't attempt it because the people who were brought in as youngsters don't have a sense of radio timing because they haven't grown up within broadcasting. It's a sad loss, but it's something that I recognize is history.
Okay. I'd like to move you on just a little bit. Among your many awards is that of Philanthropist of the Year, and that was, I think, for your work on behalf of the Terence Higgins Trust. Is there any way in which being a gay man has influenced the kind of broadcasting you do, or is your sexuality just part of your personal life?
There came a point where I looked back and I thought, did this have any role to play? The only factor which made me think that it might have is that consistently the demographic breakdown of my listeners on whatever station I've been has been more women than men, usually about 55-45. And there was one quarter where it was an exception and I had more men than women and I couldn't believe it and I almost thought, oh my God, I've been out of character somehow. There obviously is something about my voice and delivery that does appeal to women. Now, is that a kind of tenderness that comes from being a gay man? I don't know. You tell me. I mean, not you. I mean the audience. but that is a phenomenon of my career. Now, am I aware of having lost jobs because I was a gay man? No. I'm aware of having lost jobs because I was American. But those were in television rather than in radio.
Well, I think I'd pick you up on that because I think it was 1996 or thereabouts that you were invited to present that daily program on Radio 3, which attracted sometimes quite powerful criticism of what was an allegedly populist approach to classical music, but also to your American accent. Now, I wonder if that in any way scarred you.
That was a very educative experience because I was fiercely criticized before I'd even opened my mouth on the network. And it was just assumed, because I had been on Classic FM, that I was going to be playing nonstop Vivaldi Four Seasons by Nigel Kennedy and so forth. And also, I'd been on Radio 1. What a mortal offense. And so I was criticized in advance because of that. I was criticized in advance because I was an American. And I realized very, very quickly that actually I was a surrogate for who they were really criticizing, which was Liz Forgan and Nicholas Kenyon. Liz Forgan, because she had, as a stated philosophy, a widening of the voices heard on the BBC. And those persons who were of the persuasion to reject that were going to reject me. And then secondly, Nicholas Kenyon was trying to find ways to get new listeners to feel comfortable with Radio 3. And people who wanted things kept the way they were attacked him for that, and thus myself. And by the way, when it comes to journalism and critics, forget your normal impressions of newspapers. There can be lousy critics on every newspaper.
Okay. Now, we started to move there into sort of broader issues, and I'm well aware that as well as the editorial content of your broadcast, you are someone who cares about the structure of the medium, which is your principal outlet. You've worked in our UK radio now for 30 years, witnessed substantial changes, as you've already said. How would you summarise where we've come to in British radio?
I would say two very different things. I think in terms of overall radio, the BBC is now clearly the leading broadcaster in the world. It upsets me so much that my home country of the United States had the opportunity financially to construct an outstanding broadcasting system and did not. You know, when radio was invented, three major countries went three different ways with their attitudes towards radio. Britain went the Reithian way with public service. America went with Sarnoff into profit, and Germany went into propaganda with Goebbels. Well, of the three, I'll take the Reithian principles because Radio 4 in particular, and also a couple of the other BBC networks, are now clearly so far ahead of anything that is on offer in the United States or in the commercial sector in this country that I think everyone who works in this profession should be desperately trying to support BBC Radio rather than snipe. Heaven knows, when you work inside an institution, there are always grounds for criticism of the institution. But Radio 4 is so good, and most of the other BBC radio networks are so ahead of their counterparts in the rest of the world, that we've got to defend this against, I'm going to say, broadcasting illiterates. The other thing is that we have seen a peak of popular music broadcasting. And where we are now is not as good as where we were 35 years ago. And that's partly as a result of financial pressure.
So what have we lost from whenever that peak was?
We've lost a belief in the radio broadcaster. We're focusing on hiring people who are either TV celebrities or models. Can you believe that? Hiring people as radio broadcasters because they're models, which means that these skills are not being championed or taught.
Okay, well, you've made that point. I want to try and squeeze in one more question about another aspect of your professional life that we haven't considered. This conversation is obviously for the benefit of radio academicians, fellow professionals, but I do feel I want to ask about another area in which you've certainly been much celebrated, and that's the hosting of major events, such as the Ivor Novello Awards, Sony Radio Academy Awards, the Parliamentary Jazz Awards, through to some enormously impressive tributes at funerals of your former colleagues. You seem to me to be able uniquely to handle gravitas and humour, and that's never an easy thing to achieve. What is Paul Gambaccini's secret?
Well, obviously, I'm very flattered and touched by what you have just said. No person thinks he's as wonderful as someone who might be outside of him looking at him. But I am aware that when I host an event or when I have been called upon to make a eulogy, that I do slip into the moment, and I am only in that moment. I think of Bjorn Borg. It was said of Bjorn Borg that his pulse rate went down when he went on center court, because that was his natural space. And I actually get calmer when I'm hosting an event. I know this sounds ridiculous, but I'd much rather host an event than sit and watch it. Because when I'm hosting it, I know what I'm supposed to do. And I feel involved with it. I have a relationship to that event. And that perhaps is why I've had a great affection for the events that I have hosted, and why I have taken very seriously indeed the eulogies that I have been called upon to give.
Perhaps that's an explanation of why some broadcasters don't actually listen to much radio. They prefer actually making it. But does our medium provide you ever with any enjoyable experiences beyond the programming with which you're personally involved?
Of course, it has done throughout my life. It changes, however. Of course, when I was young, it was popular music broadcasters who held my fascination. But that was probably because the music was more interesting. I mean, there was that phenomenon, 1955 to 1972, in which popular music became integrated and it accepted not only black persons and the rhythm and blues music, but its derivatives, the people it influenced, from rhythm and blues music influencing the Beatles to blues influencing Led Zeppelin. And then we just had this incredible generational explosion in which the teenager as a market emerged with Elvis Presley. And it was more or less in a straight and very exciting line until the early 1970s. And then it became less vital because pop music had won. No longer was the medium the message, as McLuhan might say, and just to have a Jerry Lee Lewis record would be a symbol of rebellion. Popular music was now ubiquitous, and it is everywhere. And we now have this emphasis on syncs getting your song in commercials or TV shows. There's no place that doesn't welcome popular music. So some of that excitement is gone. Unfortunately, for broadcasters, nowadays record companies encourage their artists to release new work every 3 years rather than every 3 months. And the consequence of that is that at any given time in the charts, only one-third of your leading artists will be in action. So the quality of the music being presented by today's popular music DJs is lower than what it could be if all of the artists were performing, or than it was in the 60s and the 70s. Now, I know this is infuriating to someone who happens to be on Radio 1 or Capital FM or one of the commercial channels right now. They would love it to be as exciting as it was in the 60s. Well, I'm sorry. It just turns out that the 30s and the 60s were peaks of music, the 30s for songwriting, the 60s for record making.
Isn't it possible that that's just the way you see it, being a man of your age?
No, because I wasn't around in the 30s. I wasn't living during the period of the Great American Songbook.
But isn't it possible that a young broadcaster, 22, 23, might now feel as excited about today's music and its changes and developments as you felt about the 60s?
Every generation deserves its own popular experience. Paul Simon had his famous line, every generation throws a hero up the pop charts. But the fact is that not every decade's music is up to the all-time peak. Certainly the late 40s and early 50s were not up to what had happened in the 30s. That's just tough if you happen to be on air then. Sure, there are communities now in music that are having a great time. The electronic dance music community right now is having a great time. People who were into grime had a wonderful period. But these forms have not crossed over to be embraced by the entire world as Elvis, the Beatles, and Motown were. Of course, there is a future ahead of us, and there will be more forms that are embraced by the world, and there will be more artists like Adele who sell tens of millions of albums. But for the moment, it's Adele.
Paul Gambaccini, thank you for making time for this podcast, and may your love and knowledge of music continue to be shared with us for many years to come. My thanks also to Unique Facilities for hosting this edition. Until the next time, bye-bye.